Welcome. This podcast focuses on connecting to the history that is all around us in our own communities and the stories that shape who we are. For this episode, we head to a very special place, the grounds of the Athens Asylum. It has held its spot on a hill overlooking Athens and Ohio University for over 150 years, and its grounds and buildings, as well as the people who called it home, have many stories to tell. I'm Brian Costco, and this is Invisible Ground. Invisible Ground would like to acknowledge that we are on the traditional territory of the Kaskaskia, Osage, Shawnee, Adena, and Hopewell peoples. You can find this show wherever you find your favorite podcasts already, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. If you enjoy Invisible Ground, please help us out by subscribing, rating, and reviewing the show. You can find previous episodes and more information at findinvisibleground.com. If you'd like to be a sponsor, you have an idea to share with us, email me at Brian, B-R-I-A-N, at findinvisibleground.com. You can support the show and all of the work we do on our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/invisibleground. Or you can show your support with a donation for this project through our fiscal agent and exhibition partner at the Southeast Ohio History Center. Support for Invisible Ground comes from the Ohio University Performing Arts and Concert Series. Established in the 1950s, the Ohio University Performing Arts and Concert Series has presented and produced thousands of performances, lectures, and events over the years. It has a long reputation for serving the Ohio University and Southeastern Ohio communities by providing world-class artistry as well as talented local artists and performers. And in addition to public performances, the Ohio University Performing Arts and Concert Series has been committed to serving the educational and academic needs of students as well as the surrounding K-12 schools through outreach and master classes. Visit www.ohio.edu/live for more information, tickets, and an upcoming schedule that includes the Indigo Girls, Jason Isbell, and more. Support also comes from the Athena Cinema, located at 20 South Court Street in Athens, Ohio. The Athena Cinema is excited to announce a new series called Heroes in Color. The mission of this film series is to synergize education and entertainment, creating a unique experience for our community. At the heart of the Heroes in Color film series lies a commitment to celebrate voices and stories of people of color that have been traditionally marginalized within popular culture. By showcasing a kaleidoscope of cinematic heroes who reflect the spectrum of human stories, backgrounds, and aspirations, we strive to redefine heroism, proving that anyone, regardless of their origin, can rise to greatness. AthenaCinema.com/heroesincolor for more information. Thank you, as always, to the Southeast Ohio History Center for their continued support of this project. You can visit athenshistory.org to find out more about their work. And thanks to everyone who has supported Invisible Ground in any way. The Invisible Ground app is available for Apple and Android devices as a working prototype. And depending on when you hear this, it will probably contain three locations still for immersive historic markers. Or if you're listening to it later on, it may contain seven locations for immersive historic markers. That's because we have a new update going through sometime later in January. New markers at the Albany Enterprise Academy, Soldiers and Sailors Monument, Chancy, and at this episode's location, the Athens Asylum at the Ridges. We'll have a marker coming soon at Tablertown as well. More information at findinvisibleground.com, and be sure to keep an eye out for that app update. The Athens Asylum is one of the historical names of the institution and the complex of buildings in Athens, Ohio, that is now known as the Ridges. And maybe that distinction in names and the importance of names in general is a good place to start this episode. These buildings were known by lots of names over the years while it was in operation. The Athens Lunatic Asylum, the Athens State Hospital, and many others. For our purposes, we'll refer to the historic institution and the physical structures of it that remain as the Athens Asylum. And I'll refer to the grounds in its current form, owned and operated by Ohio University, as the Ridges. which is the name that they gave the land and location after taking over ownership of the Athens Asylum in the 1990s. With that said, a few ground rules for this episode. Number one, no spooky stuff. Like none. Or at least very little, not intended to be just spooky. The other ground rule, this is not going to be the only episode of Invisible Ground that talks about or covers the asylum. I'm not going to cover everything in this episode by any means, and I'm definitely not even covering everything I wanted to originally. But I can tell you that there will be more to come. I'm really excited for this one. So in this episode, we're going to get a lay of the land, the story of the construction of the asylum, learn about its famed architect, some of the interesting places on the grounds, and a bit more here and there. We'll also have a story from Ada Neal as part of our community storytelling project too. All right, so let's get started. As attitudes towards mental health and taking care of those in our communities in general began to grow in the 19th century, you start to see the concept of an asylum develop a bit more. In large cities especially, and in Ohio, there's several that predate the Athens one that we have here. I wanted to start out with how the Athens Asylum came to be in Athens, and what the environment looked like for mental health in places like this at the time. You're going to hear from only a few voices in this episode. The first is Dr. Catherine Ziff. She's the author of Asylum on the Hill, History of a Healing Landscape, a fantastic book, and her doctoral dissertation, which is all about the asylum. Catherine's going to give us some background on how Athens came to be chosen for the home of this institution.
William Parker Johnson, who was a physician from Athens, was tapped, of course, for the Civil War. He was head of two field hospitals in Tennessee. While he was still serving in the Civil War in his job running these field hospitals, which was very arduous, he was elected to the legislature, and he got a law passed in 1867 to make a fifth asylum in Ohio. There was already four others in existence, Dayton, Toledo, Columbus, Cleveland, and so then a committee was formed to select the site. It was going to be somewhere in southeast Ohio, and he was very good at maneuvering how all this took place, but E.H. Moore was named to be one of the three members of this selection committee. He was a person in Athens. He was a business person. He was a surveyor. His name's on one of the buildings up on Court.
It should be noted that most of the materials were made on-site or nearby, and also that a small settlement would develop down the main road from the asylum grounds, one where the builders, mechanics, carpenters, and artisans who had constructed and maintained the facility would settle and live. Mechanicsburg, as it was called, would even have its own school. And that school and the houses around it remained separate from Athens for a long time, until the whole area was annexed. Mechanicsburg School became Morrison School, and now Morrison Center, a business facility that just happens to be home to the Invisible Ground studio and office space. It's where I'm recording this right now. And as Catherine pointed out, there was a huge impact that the construction of this facility had on the local economy and resources. You'll hear from her and then Tom O'Grady afterwards.
How much, the extent to which the buildings that are there all came from really the soil and the land of Ohio, the 18.5 million bricks they estimate were made from the clay on the site. That's before they had the kilns, they set them out to dry. The ironwork of the mandalas and the windows, that was done over near Cincinnati, and the iron was, of course, we were known at that time, southeast Ohio, southern Ohio, for its ironwork. The wood was all harvested from the grounds or from nearby. So it was built, and you go through there now and you really, you know, feel the presence of how it, the building up there has a lot of, I guess, my husband's an architect and he calls it embodied energy. All the work material, you can feel it. I understand that the little settlement was for the carpenters, the stone mate, hundreds came to live here.
It was the 150th anniversary of the asylum. We had a year-long asylum speaker series at the History Center, and I asked George Eberts to speak about the real ghosts of the Athens Asylum, to talk about the people who lived there, the people who worked there, the people who built it and carried those bricks all the way to the top of those towers, because it was built at a time when there were no bulldozers or cranes or anything. That every single bit of that place was built by hand. And talk about these people and the landscape gardeners and the folks working in the farms. And if you just close your eyes, you can see a whole city of activity up there.
One of those bricklayers is someone who's come up on this show before. He even had a whole episode. A young Edward Berry. The architect for the original building was Levi T. Schofield of Cleveland, Ohio. We'll get to him in just a minute. The hospital grounds were designed by Herman Herrlin of Cincinnati, who also did the landscape design of the Oval at Ohio State University and Spring Grove Cemetery in Cincinnati. Shout out to Herman for making a place that one time in 2021, Luke forgot where he parked while we were checking it out, and we literally got lost in Spring Grove Cemetery, almost missing a Dead and Company show. The design of the buildings and the grounds surrounding them were influenced by Dr. Thomas Story Kirkbride, a 19th century physician whose work focused on mental health. In short, the Kirkbride Plan asylums are most recognizably characterized by their staggered batwing floor plan of the wards, sprawling and beautiful grounds, and architecture to match. Again, it's giving a new approach to the idea of wellness and treatment for those who lived there. In accordance with the Kirkbride Plan, the main building was to include a central administration area with one wing for men on one side and one wing for women on the other, each with their own separate dining halls. But this plan would have to be designed in order to be created and built, right? So let's learn a bit more about the architect who designed the Athens Asylum. Luckily, I have a good friend of the show who's an expert on that architect.
Levi Tucker Schofield out of Cleveland. It's the first project he did. And when he did it, it was the largest building in the state of Ohio. And he was only 26 years of age when he did it. And that's remarkable. We should feel privileged to have the opportunity to be the stewards of such an amazing wonder. And we haven't demonstrated that. Well, after he built the Athens Asylum, he fairly quickly built the Soldiers and Sailors Orphans Home in Xenia, Ohio, and jumped right onto the Columbus Asylum. Living in Cleveland, he was hired by folks to build mansions on Euclid Avenue, which Euclid Avenue at one time in world history was considered the most beautiful street in the world, Millionaire's Row. He built, I don't know, 6 or 8 of those mansions, maybe a few more. He built the prison in Mansfield that has been featured and made somewhat famous in the movie Shawshank Redemption with Morgan Freeman. He built 2 outdoor monuments, sculptural outdoor monuments in his life.
The first of those 2 monuments we will talk about is called These Are My Jewels. It's also the title of an Aqua Bear Legion archival compilation that we put out on cassette and download a few years back that features an awesome photo of the monument that I'm going to talk about here in a minute by Daniel Petroza. You can find that on aquabearlegion.bandcamp.com if you want to see the photo and listen. The sculpture, These Are My Jewels, is on the Ohio State House grounds in Columbus. It was built for the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago and sat outside the Ohio building. It features 6 of the state's Civil War heroes: Sherman, Sheridan, Grant, Hayes, Stanton, and Chase. I should point out many of them from southeastern Ohio. Above the 6 men, Cornelia, a famous woman of Roman times, towers over them. The Roman story goes that when a bunch of fancy Roman ladies were showing off their actual jewels and riches, they asked Cornelia to see hers. Cornelia, well aware that her response would remain a story in the canon for many years to come, and she could be known as number one mom, brought her children out, saying to the fancy Roman ladies who asked her the question, "These are my jewels," motioning to her children. It's an awesome sculpture and a cool Ohio twist on a classical story. And even after all of these storied works so far that we've told you about, Schofield still had another to contribute.
And then he built the Soldiers and Sailors Monument on the public square in Cleveland. We've got 4 outdoor sculpture groups with battle scenes carved into them. Horses dying, people battling. He's the sculptor and the architect, and there's a tall column, and at the top is Liberty, and she's armed with a sword and a shield in defense of freedom. And it's a little building that you go into, and in the inside there were 3-4 relief sculptures around the base of that big monument. And they just represent so much of Ohio's contribution to the Civil War.
Tom told me that our asylum in Athens, designed by Schofield, was one of the biggest in Ohio at the time it opened. Schofield would build the next biggest he could when he did the Columbus Asylum a few years later. Now that the Athens Asylum, was ready to open, community seemed aware of both its importance and its connection to Athens.
They laid the cornerstone in 1868. There was a huge parade, 10,000 people, according to the newspaper. Masons at that time did cornerstone laying, and they, Masons, 1,000 Masons came, Masonic temple people came from all over the state. So it was a big deal. We still haven't found that cornerstone. And then 1874, January 1st, their first patients began to be admitted.
The buildings and the grounds were designed before we had drugs or any other types of treatment. It was thought that the best thing we can do is give these people asylum, refuge, safety, protection, and surround them with maximum of beauty, whether it's the beauty of the buildings they lived in or the beauty of the grounds that surrounded them.
I mentioned at the beginning of this episode that we were going to deal with some really huge topics, even for Invisible Ground. That is to say, I wish I had more time to go into detail on the history of mental health and treatment and all the things that relate that to our own asylum here in Athens. I plan to spend some more time on that in the future with more episodes.
The big discussion for 100 years has been, how did asylums arise? Were they there to provide humanitarian care? Were they there to provide social control? And the answer is both. Many, many examples of humanitarian care. Women in postpartum distress who were brought back to health, who were in terrible, all kinds of things. There to provide better care for people who had been perhaps examples, chained in a barnyard, chained in the basement, you know. And then there was social control. There was the coal miner in Nelsonville who was hospitalized. The notes say he was good health. His pulse was good, but he had an illness and it was caused by overstudy of the labor question. He was trying to start a chapter of the Knights of Labor. He's trying to start a labor union in Nelsonville. Also, men who were without a house, homeless, were called tramps. It's a great evil. These are people who are not productive. You had to produce and do something for society. So tramps were rounded up and hospitalized. Some actually were pretty clever. They would show up around the asylum around wintertime, and then spring they would drift away because there was a lot of access to the outdoors for many patients. So women who were doing irregular things, like she was running through brush and stone, behaving in a very odd way. Let's go to the asylums. And then it was also just the despair of families not knowing how to care for someone. And you can look and read the diagnoses then were not unlike what we have now. Similar things to depression. They had mania, and they had different things. Regulating society, social control, and also for humanitarian reasons. Care was free, by the way, except for your clothes. Up until the early 1900s, you had to bring your clothes, but then they would furnish you with clothes as you needed them.
The grounds themselves also tell the stories of the people, and the history of the institution is all around the landscape, inside and outside. The main administration building became Lynn Hall and the Kennedy Museum of Art at the Ohio Museum Complex. And they're the ones to thank for all the awesome signs all around at the ridges. And I want to give a special thanks to Nancy and everyone there for helping to get our QR code for our eventual immersive historic marker out on their new sign out front. If you walk around those grounds, there's an orchard off the hiking trails. Even further away, there's the Dairy Barn Art Center down, well, Dairy Lane, which once was the Dairy Barn for the asylum. There's the auditorium, old lampposts up on the hillsides, and old Packard-designed cottages that cover the grounds among the much larger Kirkbride buildings. The Horse Barn would become Ohio University's Child Development Center after renovations. And it's back there that you can find most of the original fountain that was out front. It's still there back among some weeds and tucked away. A far cry from when a crocodile was photographed in it out front of the building after a doctor drove said crocodile back in his car with his family from Florida. We'll post a photo of Jim Crocs, but you can see it on the wall when you go into the Kennedy Museum too. Those nature trails that fork out from the asylum buildings and around the whole Ridges complex are special too. Let's talk about one of those spots in particular, the highest one, Radar Hill. Here's Aidan Neal with a new piece as part of our community storytelling program all about Radar Hill. Enjoy.
Nestled in the hills of the ridges hides the highest point in Athens, Radar Hill. This hiking spot is popular for its 360-degree view of the city. While the scenery is beautiful, Radar Hill is a hidden gem of history, displaying the decades of change that have made its way through the area. The grounds were originally owned and operated by the Athens Asylum. The hill included part of the orchard and held livestock used by the asylum residents. During World War II, the hill was repurposed as a defense radar station by the U.S. Army, thus becoming Radar Hill. After the war, Ohio University began conducting research in cooperation with the Air Force at the site. In 1963, a satellite was installed on the hill and research shifted to focus on lunar surface studies in collaboration with Ohio State University. This work was funded by a grant from NASA designed to provide information for the Apollo project later that decade. 3 years later, the university became owner of the world's only privately operated tracking station. The station was a gift from President of SOHIO, Charles E. Spahr, for the university's capability in microwave research. The station was commended for its involvement in tracking America's first artificial satellite, Explorer 1. This new station made it possible to receive and transmit signals from the same location, while other stations previously had to be separated by 50 miles. Despite these achievements, the engineering department would not stay at Radar Hill. In 1969, the department would move out of the lab due to rapid ongoing technological advances. The lab buildings and structures remained abandoned for many years, subject to vandalism and decay. I spoke with Tom O'Grady, Director of Outreach at the Southeast Ohio History Center. O'Grady arrived in Athens in 1980 and volunteered at the asylum until its closure.
So one of the things I would occasionally do is take clients for hikes up into the orchard and stuff. We'd always end up at Radar Hill and look at the mess and come back. They weren't interested. And then I did my master's thesis on the asylum. I thought Radar Hill, even in the poor condition it was in, was a great opportunity to create a place for an observatory, because there were already two really sturdy masonry buildings up there. And so I thought we could heat it and stuff with solar greenhouse attachments. We could repurpose that radio telescope and use it for tracking radio satellites and then put a couple domes up.
Despite high hopes of repurposing the buildings, the university would end up having them demolished. The university's treatment of historical buildings has been scrutinized by the community, many hoping they will make an effort to maintain and repurpose rather than tearing them down. The lack of preservation of historical buildings in Southeast Ohio only takes away from the character that makes the region so unique. Today, Radar Hill is part of the Ohio University Ridges Land Lab. Established in 1989, the Land Lab is a topographically and biologically diverse natural area for instruction and research in field biology, environmental geography, and ecosystem ecology. Dr. Rebecca Snell, a professor in the Environmental and Plant Biology Department, told me about some of the work being done at Radar Hill. Dr. Snell says while the asylum's livestock lived on the hill, a non-native grass called meadow fescue was planted. This grass was great for livestock, but made it to where nothing else was able to grow.
And so with restoration ecology, the idea with restoration ecology is that we're trying to basically improve an ecosystem, or we're trying to basically restore an ecosystem to maybe what it should have been before, so it got damaged by humans. And so in 2013, Dr. DeForest, who's another professor in our department, started working at Radar Hill. So he decided, let's do this. And so let's try to restore this area to what should be a tall grass prairie.
Those working on the restoration have been slowly replacing the meadow fescue with native plants in hopes of restoring biodiversity. The restoration has been slow moving, taking the time to smother the fescue and then reseed that area. Despite the timeliness, progress is being made. Dr. Snell encourages people to go up to Radar Hill and take note of the changes.
So I think it's kind of helpful to see like what it looked like probably before. I mean, it's changing on the other side too as some of those species cross the path. But that is a pretty good representation of probably what it looked like before. And then if you look to the other side, you'll see it's just so much taller and you'll see A lot of flowers out there, especially if you go in the summer, you'll see a lot of different, there's like blazing star out there now, which is really pretty. It's those tall purple spikes. There's sometimes cone flowers. We're trying to get goldenrod up there. So there's some, you know, really pretty things happening. So I'd say go and look.
These days, the area looks about how it started. Radar Hill itself, among the hiking trails and nature preserves, is still part of the story of this land. While the radar station didn't last long, the legacy of the accomplishments there outlive any building. Based in its history, but existing in an ever-changing world, the history here is intertwined with the promise of progress. Whether it's eyes to the sky or into the grass, Radar Hill continues to change and adapt to the needs of the community.
Thanks, Aiden. That was awesome. You'll be hearing more stories from them in the future. And if you have an interest in this particular part of the Invisible Ground project, reach out to me, brian@findinvisibleground.com, if you want to learn more about the community storytelling project. Radar Hill, the nature trails, and the preserve are all important parts of the ridges. Within the grounds, there's also three cemeteries that are the final resting places for people who died while at the asylum. Many of those graves numbered, many of those people and their lives and stories forgotten. But some people are doing incredible work to bring those stories back to life. Sherry Russo, who works for WOUB Public Media in Athens, also produces a podcast called Who Lies Beneath? The Asylum. And it does just that. Be sure to check the show out wherever you listen to podcasts already. It's a really good one. I had a chance to talk to Sherry about the podcast and her work. She tells us about the trail that connects the three cemeteries and how her own research began.
There's a walking path back there now, and so you can walk back there and really experience all of them. But each one kind of represents a different time period of the asylum and how they were burying the people who died there. And there's one, I think it's Cemetery 2, and so I'm not 100% sure about this, but I think it's Cemetery 2 that kind of looks like Arlington National Cemetery. Like, it's just rows of these same level white grave markers. And because of the work that NAMI in Athens did to clean up the cemeteries, because they were in a state of disarray several years ago, you know, it just looks beautiful. It looks serene. It's a proper resting place if their names were on the tombstones. You know, it really feels like that's missing. It started with the log book at the asylum, and you know, and there was a name, and there was, in some cases, there was a date that they were admitted, in some cases there were some admission records, but it was all really spotty. You know, the basic story is that many of these people probably either didn't have family when they died, or the family that they did have, the stigma of having someone committed made it where they didn't claim them when they died. So they didn't have anywhere to send them when they died at the asylum, so they buried them under a number.
Eli Stevens, the Confederate, I believe he was a member of Morgan's Raiders and ended up somehow in jail in Benton County and then in the asylum. He's buried next to Israel Johnson, a black man from Big Run in Athens County.
These are incredible stories, even in their final resting places. The cemetery trails are maintained along with the grounds around them by NAMI, a national organization for mental illness. It's a mix of nature, history, and memorial, something that I cannot recommend highly enough. Maybe Invisible Ground should organize a walk up there. And it reminds us that the people should be at the forefront here too. That each one of these stories, each one of these patients, is a real human being. And in some cases, they weren't afforded too much agency while they were living either.
These people did not have a voice in their own lives. You know, they were committed maybe for proper reasons, but maybe not. I mean, we've learned that, you know, at that time, if a husband had found someone else or just wanted out of the marriage for whatever reason, they could say that she needed to be committed, and they took the word of the husband, and that was it. So these people didn't didn't have a voice in a lot of cases in their own care and what happened to them.
So many people have a connection to this place and to institutions everywhere that are similar. Each one of those numbers in that graveyard, each one of the names in a logbook, is a human being. I don't have enough time in this episode to include as many of those stories as I would like, but I wanted to share one more. This was submitted online through our Google Voice account by Robert, and he told us about his own connection to the asylum.
I'm calling about the Ridges and your podcast. I think I have a unique story to share. I have a deep connection to the Athens Mental Health Center. In 1965, when I was 10 years of age, my father was committed to the institution. He was suffering from psychosis due to alcoholism. And I can remember walking up those front steps to visit him with my grandmother, holding her hand, only to be turned away because they had placed him in a straitjacket and he couldn't be seen. That was in 1965 when I was 10. Fast forward to 1975, when I was a junior living in outside housing, and my roommate came home one day, and it was clear that she was in a mental health emergency. She was very manic. She set fire to the bathroom, and I talked her into going over to the health center, and they admitted her immediately. When I went back to visit her the next day, I couldn't believe it when they told me that they had placed her in a straitjacket. And I just had these flashbacks from, you know, the previous 10 years. Anyway, I feel attached to those grounds. And I usually visit once a year, and I drive up the hill, and I end up staring at those steps. And half the time, I end up crying, and I often think someone's going to come out asking me to leave.
Where do we go from here? What'll happen here? I've said it a few times, and so have our guests, but this is just a very special place. History is so present. You're experiencing it outdoors in this beautiful and unique environment. And it's my favorite place to hike, whether in the woods or even just on the brick roads that circle the Kirkbride buildings. All of it's special. And it puts Athens and Ohio University in a very unique situation. Why are the Ridges important? And why is it important to save places like this?
Well, for me, in my mind, there dwells many of the images from the old photographs, you know, the old gardens, the lakes that were down at the foot, small lakes, big ponds, where the river is now. And then what dwells with me also is some tours I had of the interiors very early on, about the year 2001, hadn't been closed for that long. The asylum closed in 1993. It came down from the hill to its current location, across the way, across the river. And so I feel, and in my mind, I experience those empty spaces that yet seemed at that time, and it's kind of lives with me still, a very, just an atmosphere, a certain atmosphere of healing. There's also some sadness and poignancy and some very beautiful aspects and some difficult aspects when you get down into the basement and see some of those storage spaces. So there's that. Now, I have spent hours and hours, as many people have in Athens, hiking up there. So the landscape lives with me. The paths have now been kind of rejuvenated. There's some nice signage up there now. It looks well-tended. Paths in the woods, the paths that go up to Radar Hill. Every season has its own beauty up there. You know, the fall and the spring when things are just starting out. Even the winter, when you see people up there trudging through the snow, have their winter experience up there. So the grounds, the forests, the old fields, the former orchards with the vestiges are still there. The old cemeteries, there are three, of course, up there. The landscape lives with me. And if anyone hasn't been up there, go now, because they've got new plans coming, new things coming. So it's good to go up now and see it very much as it may have been, you know, 20 years ago when it was just ending its farming operations.
Another thing about this is, somebody pointed this out to me some years ago, that this small town of Athens, there are these two institutions that sit on two hills across the Hocking Valley from each other, and they were both built to deal with issues of the mind, the educational facility at the university and then the asylum to help people who were struggling with mental health issues. What a unique opportunity for a small town, and to still have this in the, we're a quarter of the way now into the 21st century. It's the last asylum in Ohio. It's the last complex like that, and it's an American treasure. It could be an attraction to people from not only all around Ohio, but America. The buildings and the grounds were designed before we had drugs or any other types of treatment. It was thought that the best thing we could do is give these people asylum, refuge, safety, protection, and surround them with maximum of beauty, whether it's the beauty of the buildings they lived in or the beauty of the grounds that surrounded them.
Thank you to everyone involved with this episode, including Dr. Catherine Ziff, Sherry Russo, Tom O'Grady. Thanks to Robert for calling in and sharing his story. We really appreciate that. Thanks a lot to Ada Neal for their story on Radar Hill. You'll be hearing a lot more from them in the future. Thanks as well to Dr. Nancy Stevens and everyone at the Ohio Museum Complex for their help in getting our QR code for the Asylum Immersive Historic Marker added to their amazing signage that will be coming in the spring. That site is right outside the main building at the Ridges, and it'll be added to the app along with three more here soon. Check for updates in the Apple and Android store sometime later in January. We will also announce on social media. Thanks to Taylor Burnett, Tommy Stump, and Chad Rich, who helped with audio editing for this episode. Music for this one comes from the Powers Rollin duo, Daniel Bachman, Keith Hanlon, Bill McKay, Weed Ghost, The Peel, Disjointed Mike, Unmonumental, Cold Snack, Dead Winds of Summer, Matthew J. Rollin, and Todd Jacobs, who does our theme. You can get a whole album's worth of that soundtrack, 16 songs from 16 different projects. The Music of Invisible Ground is available on vinyl, CD, and download, aquabearlegion.bandcamp.com. You can also order shirts, prints, and more at findinvisibleground.com. Thanks again to our underwriters for this episode, the Ohio University Performing Arts and Concerts Series. You can visit www.ohio.edu/live to find more information about their work, tickets, and an upcoming schedule that includes the Indigo Girls, Jason Isbell, and more. And also the Athena Cinema at 20 South Court Street in Athens, Ohio. Find more info about their Heroes in Color program, as well as private rental packages, athenacinema.com, and we appreciate your support. Invisible Ground is an exhibition partner with the Southeast Ohio History Center. Thank you for all you do. Visit athenshistory.org to learn more about that. Grant support for Invisible Ground comes from the Ohio History Connection, Ohio Humanities, Athens County Foundation, Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family, Ohio's Winding Road, and additional support from our donors and supporters, both individuals and businesses. There's a full list of those people and places on our website at findinvisibleground.com. Thank you for supporting and believing in this project. Go see all of the Invisible Ground markers. Three of them are in Athens right now. Many more to come with that update later in the month. Download the app for Apple and Android, and you'll be able to see and experience historic photos at designated immersive historic marker sites. Check out this podcast and previous episodes where you listen to your favorite podcasts already, or at invisibleground.simplecast.com. And please subscribe, rate, and review. It really does help. Tell your friends too, spread the word. And if you have an idea for a show or you'd like to help us out with some fundraising or sponsorship, reach out to me, Brian at findinvisibleground.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.